Native American poet Deborah Miranda, author of the 2020 book Altar of Broken Things, teaches at Virginia's Washington and Lee University and describes how her earlier book, Bad Indians, morphed while telling her home state's history of tribes and Spanish colonial missions in California.
I actually did not start out to write a memoir, let alone a tribal memoir. I thought I was writing a really nice academic book that would get me tenure. And as it turns out, I did use this book to get tenure, but it had a will of its own, and the voices in it had a particular design in mind. And I struggled really hard to resist the sort of multi-genre text that came out. But eventually, I came to realize that that was what I had been meant to write all along.
Discover the literary inspirations and creative process behind Deborah Miranda's book that won both a gold medal from the Independent Publishers Association and the Penn Oakland Josephine Miles Literary Award. Bad Indians, a Tribal Memoir, today on New Letters on the Air, a production of New Letters Magazine at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. I'm Angela Elam, and we recorded the writer at the University of Central Missouri's 2016 Pleiades Visiting Writers Series, where she showed maps of the missions and tribes around the Monterey Bay area of California. A fitting beginning for this author, whose first poetry collection was the 1999 book, Indian Cartography. Here's Deborah Miranda.
I want to start out with a quote from Elizabeth Cook Lynn. She is a Crow Creek Lakota woman, a poet, a scholar, a novelist. But this quote says that art and literature and storytelling are at the epicenter of all that an individual or a nation intends to be. And a nation which does not tell its own stories cannot be said to be a nation at all. This is a crucial quote for Indigenous people, but especially for me as a California writer. It is not surprising that a lot of people don't know anything about California Indians and don't know anything about the California history of missionization out of which many of us in the southern portion of the state come out of. Northern California was severely affected by the gold rush. Southern California was affected by missionization by Spanish Franciscan priests. And those of us in the mid-coast area in Carmel and Monterey, we got hit with both the 49 gold rush and with missionization. So that's a lot of trauma to absorb. Another quote that helped me formalize the structure of this book from Gloria Anzaldúa from Borderlands. I see a mosaic pattern, and she puts in parentheses Aztec-like, emerging, a weaving pattern, thin here, thick there. This almost finished product seems an assemblage, a montage, now appearing, now disappearing in a crazy dance. The whole thing has a mind of its own, escaping me and insisting on putting together the pieces of its own puzzle with minimal direction from my will. That is exactly how I felt about this book, and it was what led me to finally accept that the book was, in fact, coming into a mosaic pattern, rather than me laying things out in a really linear fashion and approaching it from a very Western academic point of view. So, for sort of a metaphor, I decided to start out with looking at the mission mythology that is behind California. I think one way to look at it is to imagine it the way the maps are given. Fourth grade across the U.S. is the big local history, social sciences project, right? So in Washington State, we did the Oregon Trail unit. Here, as we were driving around, I saw the Santa Fe Trail. Every section of the U.S. has this moment when the historians have to address, how did we get here? How did this land become ours, so to speak? So if we look at a map of some of the California areas, San Carlos Borromeo, which is also known as Carmel Mission, which is where my grandfather's people were from, what you see is pretty much a coastal map of California with these little churches or these little crosses and all of the missions named on them. There are actually 21 California missions, but naming and mapping are two really big projects for colonization because you must claim that land in many ways, and linguistically and physically are two of the biggest ways. The idea of road or El Camino, this is not a natural state of things. Native people had paths that came and went with the seasons. Oftentimes they were the paths that were also used by animals. They were not these roads. In California, it was called El Camino Real, the King's Road. This well-worn path established through conscious plan, indicative of permanence, a channel of traffic imposed on the natural landscape for specific, and I should say, man-made purposes. So it's a way in which you separate the land from itself. This is something very disruptive that roads do. If we were thinking, we were trying to come up with a more indigenous perspective on the state of California, you might think that a map like this, which has named most of, if not all, of the California tribal territories, and of course, even just turning it into a map is actually not very accurate, but for our purposes, we'll think about it this way. This makes the state clearly indigenous. And so this is something that I often try to show people to explain what California missionization did, what happened to it. But it's still not telling the whole story. So I searched and searched and searched for a map that did this. I probably started maybe 10, 15 years ago. Just last year, I finally found one. And this is the first time that you really start to see the impact of these missions on indigenous populations. You might mistakenly think, oh, it just affected the coastal people, but of course it didn't, because when you had the people in the missions die off, the soldiers had to go off into the hills further and further and further inland and bring in more converts. So it's almost cancerous the way that these missions ate away at the indigenous peoples. So you see the unseen history. Southern California missions actually invaded indigenous homelands, created a situation where these indigenous peoples were oppressed and enslaved in many, many cases. And that makes a big difference in how you perceive California and how you perceive this mythology. If you go to California, everything is built in the quote-unquote mission style, this fake stucco and the red clay roof tiles, but at the same time, the complete erasure of indigenous people. A lot of people don't think there are any California Indians left. And I once went to a writing workshop and met up with another California Indian, and we were having a wonderful little meeting, and we saw another Native woman walk by, so we called her over, and she was from Oregon. And the first question, what tribe are you from? We tell each other. And she looked at me and this other California Indian woman and said, I thought all you California Indians were dead. This is another Indian from the next state, okay? We're not dead.
You're listening to Deborah Miranda on New Letters on the Air as she describes her path to writing the award-winning book, Bad Indians, a Tribal Memoir, revealing some of her home state's little-known history.
Another thing that has led to the erasure of California Indians is this idea early on of the population drop. So I actually had to do an intervention. Originally, this graph said that there were 300,000 Indians at the time of contact, and that is the number that has been given since maybe the 1900s, when ethnologists were beginning to work on California Indian research. And it's been very, very hard to budge that. However, recently Richard Thornton did a really, really nice study in which he shows that there were at least 1 million Native Californians at the time of contact. So when people saw that there were 300,000 and oops, they went down to maybe 90,000 or so, maybe that's not such a bad drop. But when you think about 1 million people, and you end up down at this very low level in such a short span of time, then you start to realize, oh, this is a Holocaust. This is an apocalyptic event in indigenous people's lives. So getting the right numbers out there and insisting on them is an extremely important thing to do. And you would be surprised at how many people, when I lecture like this in California, come up and argue with me about this number. They don't want to think that many people died, because then they have to think about how it happened. So my goals with this book, I wanted to make or remap California Indian history. I wanted to put us on the map for the first thing, but I also wanted to make it visible. And I had a lot of different ideas. So I wanted to collect fragments of culture, and I think that's kind of a no-brainer, because for California Indians, all we have left are fragments of culture. There are very few whole cultures left in California. My tribes, the Esalen up in Carmel and the Chumash down in Santa Ynez, a little further south, definitely had this brunt of 100 years of missionization, which broke up all of our religious, linguistic, cultural, familial events and guess you would say, our spiritual center. I wanted to create a literary vehicle for those fragments, something that would help those fragments make sense, and things that would speak in some way that fragmented lives could not speak. But perhaps if I brought them together, they would help inform each other. And then finally, I wanted to push the boundaries for how we think about performing testimony or witnessing. There's a lot of discussion about the literature of resistance and literature of witness, but it's usually coming from perhaps one single person who is made to stand as a representative for the whole nation. And in this case, I didn't have that. We disappeared so quickly, and we were spread out into a diaspora so quickly that there really isn't just one person who can do this for us. Okay, so a little less lecturing, a little more poetry. A painting that I found, a French, I think it was Peru, who visited Carmel Mission. So this is a Carmel Indian woman. And I paired this with a letter from Junipero Serra, the priest who founded the mission and founded the California Indian Mission effort. I went into his book of translated letters using his archival material, and I created a found poem out of his own words. So the idea of using Serra's words to talk about the genocide that he created really appealed to me. I wanted him to cop to it. So this is called Los Pájaros, based on writings by Junipero Serra, May 1773 and June 1774. Seeing your people come through the fields, we noticed a great flock of birds of various and beautifully blended colors, such as we had never seen before. We noticed a great flock of birds swooping out of the heavens just ahead, such as we had never seen before, as if they had come to welcome our newly arrived guests. Swooping out of the heavens, just ahead, six or more soldiers set out together on horseback, as if they came to greet their newly acquired hosts in the far distant rancherias, even many leagues away. Six or more soldiers set out by horseback, both men and women at sight of them took to their heels, in the far distant rancherias, even many leagues away, fleeing the soldiers, clever as they are at lassoing cows. Both men and women at sight of them took to their heels, but the women were caught with Spanish ropes. The soldiers, clever as they are at lassoing cows, preyed on the women for their unbridled lust. The women were caught with Spanish ropes. Indian men defended their wives, pray for the Spaniards' unbridled lust, only to be shot down with bullets. The Indian men tried to defend their wives of various and beautifully blended colors, only to be shot down with bullets, seeing your people come through the fields.
Los Pájaros, The Birds, the first poem in the multi-genre book Bad Indians, a tribal memoir, published in 2013 by Heyday Press. This is New Letters on the Air, and here's Deborah Miranda on why she chose to go with a hybrid text.
My primary audience always has been other California Indians. Although I moved out of California when I was five, my mother moved us up to Washington State, and I lost all connections with my tribe because my connections were through my father. My father had gone into San Quentin prison. And so my mother wanted to be done with all of that. She moved up to Washington State. But when I was 13, my father was released and he came back to the family. I had sort of a crash course in how to be a California Indian. And so by the time I was starting to write this book, I was back into the community. My sister Louise is chair of the tribe. We were petitioning for re-recognition from the United States. We'd been illegally dropped off the federally enrolled tribe list, and it was a hot mess. So I was very much involved in that political and very spiritual movement of trying to re-educate the United States government, but also re-educate our own people. So California Indians were my primary audience. I knew that they, like myself, really needed a voice to represent them and to tell the stories that were there, but that they couldn't all access. Obviously, I did have the academic world in my sights, but not just because I wanted tenure. I wanted to put something out in the world that people could bring into their classes. I wanted a place for people to go who wanted to teach California Indian literature and history and culture. A book like this did not exist. It just wasn't there. There were a few Native writers, there were a few texts, but really there was nothing that told this story about missionization. So academics needed to be educated as well, and I knew that if it could get into the university level, I would have a whole new generation of young people who could then educate themselves. But I didn't stop there. I wanted a book that would also be accessible to the general public, a book that would not be weighed down quite so much with theory as much as enacting the theory. And I really had a very strong feeling that storytelling was the way to go, that storytelling is the way into other people's hearts. Sometimes you can educate people in an intellectual way through the emotional storytelling. And so that became sort of the third step in where I was hoping this book would go. And the second reason I wanted to do this, aside from those audience, was because I knew that the capacity for subverting that dominant narrative, that mythology of California, would be really, really well served in a book which brought in all of these different pieces and showed people what the real narrative was. This idea of being polyvocal, of bringing in many voices but making them stand for one voice. I knew that that would really help subvert that fourth grade mission project. So I looked around for permission. I wanted somebody to tell me it was okay to do this weird stuff with this material. And I realized that I actually had seen it done in some places. And the first thing I thought of was Leslie Marmon Silko's book, Storyteller. She does things like include family stories, tribal stories, family pictures, cultural information. She put it all together. She had this fiction, she had poetry, she had all kinds of creative nonfiction narrative, I think we'd call it now, and created a very well-blended book. So, surprise, surprise, I wasn't doing anything brand new. But it's nice to have permission. A couple other books that I'll just mention quickly, Only What We Could Carry from Heyday Press, which coincidentally ended up being the company that published Bad Indians. It's a book about the Japanese internment camps. And although it's not all one author, it's an edited volume, it was extremely multi-genre. They had excerpts there from Citizen 16660, which is an early graphic novel about the internment camps. They had the broadsides that were published on the street that said, you must go to these internment camps. They had poetry. They had memoir narratives. Again, I was seeing that it was possible to put all of these things together in one text, and that, you know, if I could find the right publisher, that would be something. Another one was Dorothy Allison's Two or Three Things I Know for Sure, which is also playing with the idea of using family photographs to play off the narratives, but also because Allison takes huge risks in there. She's talking about her own life. She's talking about incest. She's talking about rape of a child. She's talking about being lesbian. She's putting things into this story that make it incredibly powerful, things that I was worried about writing about. So the subversive benefits of doing a mosaic text began to become clear to me, and they started to really appeal in many ways. Some of the things that a mosaic text can do that another text cannot are privileging a more indigenous sense of time and organizing that nonlinear sense of time for mainstream readers. Because as much as I love nonlinear, I understand that many people aren't familiar with it and need a little bit of guidance with it. So that's something that a mosaic can do. I loved how hybrid texts can transform the literary discourses from traditional archival sources. Because California Indians did not, obviously, keep written records, because so much of the oral record had been genocided out of us, one of the things I had to do was approach the colonizers' archive with an open mind and say, okay, this is going to contain some awful stuff, but there are Native stories hidden in those Western archives, things that were sort of accidentally placed in there for me to find. So that's definitely something a hybrid text does that I had not previously considered.
Deborah Miranda on her book, Bad Indians, a tribal memoir, part of the 2016 Pleiades Visiting Writers Series at the University of Central Missouri. Ahead on New Letters on the Air, we'll hear a novena she composed during her research.
Some of the archives that I plundered were newspaper articles, one published in 1909 from the Los Angeles Times. And the headline caught my eye, Bad Indian Goes on Rampage at Santa Ynez. Santa Ynez was the mission that my grandmother's people were from, the Chumash people, so I was especially interested. And then as I read the first line, Juan Miranda, a bad Indian on the reservation at Santa Ynez, got on a rampage today thanks to some fire water. I was immediately drawn in, even though I have to say the Mirandas that were at Santa Ynez were not my Mirandas. I think somewhere we were connected, probably through some soldier at the baptismal font. The story goes on that as the constable and the game warden went over to reconnoiter, somehow I think there was some poaching going on, the two officers approached Miranda's cabin. The Indian came out of the door with a .44 caliber Winchester, which he leveled at them. Next, there emerged from the cabin the Indian's daughter with a six-shooter. She was followed by the man's wife, who had chosen a double-barreled shotgun for hers. Okay, I'm like, yeah, these are my family. We stick together, right? So there's not a big, wonderful battle or anything, no Western shootout. Poor Juan gets clubbed over the head by the constable, and they're all dragged off to jail. But it's interesting that the headline over says militant brave, the bad Indian. I started thinking about the fact that all through these records, the missions, I have to say, kept records on everything. So there's a book of births, a book of marriages, and a book of burials for each mission. And so I can follow my family. My mother did our genealogy back to the very first year of the first mission. There are some of my family in that book. So looking at this, I realized in all those archives, I kept finding members of my family called bad Indians. So-and-so is a bad Indian. He keeps poaching cattle. So-and-so is a bad Indian. She keeps running away. So-and-so is a bad Indian. She sleeps around. So-and-so is a bad Indian. He's had children with many women. Just this constant barrage of badness. And I started to realize the reason I'm still here by a very thin thread is because of those bad ancestors who broke the rules and that allowed them to stay alive. Oftentimes I can go down my family tree and see somebody lived just long enough to have a child and then they died. And that's how thin that thread really is. So playing around with some of the what I call Catholic paraphernalia that my family has inherited, I hit on the idea of writing a novena to the bad Indians. A novena is a Catholic prayer that typically is said over the course of 9 days, and it's usually a supplication asking for help. Usually you would say a novena to a saint. These bad Indians are my saints. This poem is called Novena to Bad Indians. The epigraph says, "The only good Indians I ever knew were dead. General Philip Sheridan." Day one. Indian outlaws, bandidos, renegades, rebels, lazy Indians, sinful Indians, you gamblers who squatted out behind the church instead of assuming the missionary position behind the plow. Oh, lusty Indians who tied bones to sheets thrown out of the women's monjerio, climbed up that swaying skeleton of salvation and made unsanctified love all night. Oh, women who tossed down those sheets, hear my prayer. Day two. Hail, troublemakers, horse thieves, fornicators, I implore you, polygamists, deer dancers, idol worshippers, chasers of loose women, heathens who caroused in the hills, stole wine from the sacristy, graffitied Indian designs on the church wall, told coyote stories instead of practicing catechism, torched mission wheat fields, set fire to tule roofs, ran away, were captured, flogged, put in stocks or irons, ran away again. Help me, suffer me in this hour of loss. Day three. I ask for your grace, you dirty Indians, you stupid Indians who wouldn't learn Spanish or English, lazy bastards who mumbled no quiero when asked to load wagons with tons of stinking skins, who chased the bottle instead of cattle, who were late for mass, confessed everything and repented nothing, took the whip thick as a fist, laughing. You who loved soapstone charms, glass beads, eagle feathers, but wouldn't learn proper usage of land or gold. Have mercy on my weakness. Day 4. Queens of Earth, you women who sold yourselves for a tortilla, a handful of beans, the dog's meat. Sons of incorrigible cattle thieves like Juan Nepomuceno, who could no longer find elk or deer or salmon. Cabecillos, ringleaders like Hilario, who endured the novenario for throwing a stone at a missionary. 25 lashes on 9 consecutive days, and then on 9 consecutive Sundays, 40 more. Oh, my martyrs, grant me strength. Grant me courage in my desperation. Day 5. Oh, magnificent Aniceto, who refused to name thieves of money, chocolate, shoes, string, knives from the Presidio. 13 years old, you took a flogging in silence. Oh, renowned Yoscolo, a calde from Mission Santa Clara, who raided mission stores, freed 200 women from the Monjarillo. Dear Atanasio, found guilty of stealing from the Comisario, shot dead by a firing squad at 17 years of age, begging for your life as you knelt in the estuary at Monterey. Guide me out of the stone walls of this cell. Day 6. Accept my praise song, you women who aborted pregnancies conceived in rape by soldier or priest. Attend me, barren Indian woman, stripped and prodded, who refused to let Father Ramon Olbes examine your genitals or test your fertility. You, who bit him, suffered 50 lashes, shackles, imprisonment, a shaved head, were forced to carry a wooden false baby for 9 days. Blessed Apolinario, midwife, curandera, dancer, keeper of potent medicines, heal me. Day 7. Ever full of faith, Pomponio, who cut off your heel with your own knife to slip out of leg irons. Terrible heart of Toypurina, shaman revolutionary, who dared raise your gods against Spain's. Blessed Chumash woman who heard the earth goddess Chupa tell you to rebaptize neophytes in the tears of the sun. Leki Samne, most merciless Estanislao, telling the padre, we are rising in revolt. We have no fear of the soldiers. Make me unrepentant. Day 8. O valiant Venancio, Julian, Donato, Antonio, Lino, Vicente, Miguel, Andre, Emiliana Tata, Maria, who suffocated Father Andre Quintana at Santa Cruz before he could test his new wire-tipped whip. Oh, Nazario, personal cook to Father Panto at San Diego, who slipped hierba, powdered cuchas que la hay, into the padre's soup after enduring 124 lashes. You said, I could find no other way to revenge myself. I beseech your tenderness. Day 9. Oh, unholy pagans who refused to convert. Oh, pagans who converted. Oh, pagans who recanted. Oh, converts who survived. Hear our supplication. Make us in your image. Grant us your pride. Ancestors, illuminate the dark civilization we endure. Teach us to love untamed. Inspire us to break rules. Remind us of your brutal wisdom learned so dearly. Even dead Indians are never good enough. So those bad Indians are my heroes. I think sometimes a bad Indian is a good ancestor. I just want to say, Nimasiana Kelpasaleki, which means my heart feels good, which means thank you.
Deborah Miranda with Novena to Bad Indians from her book that won a gold medal from the Independent Publishers Association and a Penn Oakland Josephine Miles Literary Award. For a link to Heyday Books' Bad Indians, a tribal memoir, and her fourth poetry collection out from Bookmark Press in 2020 called Altar of Broken Things, visit bkmkpress.org. From New Letters Magazine at UMKC, today's show was produced with Danny Moran, Cassie Vaughn, and Jamie Walsh. I'm Angela Elam for New Letters on the Air.